You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Either you have enough water or you don't. Life of all kinds depends upon the answer to that question. Along with farmers, all big cities wrestle with water issues, and some of that precious water disappears half a world away to make products that we buy. That's all in a new book, Your Water Footprint, The Shocking Facts About How Much Water We Use to Make Everyday Products. It's by the professional environmental journalist Stephen Leahy. We have him on the line now. Steve, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
So your new book takes us places I didn't expect. Just the cover is shocking. Really, does it take 240 gallons of water to make a modern mobile phone? How is that possible?
Well, there's a lot of parts to a mobile phone. We've got microchips, you've got metals, you've got plastic, you've got batteries, you've got silica glass. There's lots of parts to it. So, and it takes water to make all of those parts. It's one of the things I learned in researching his book, is it takes water to make everything.
All right. Another factoid that interested me, how much water does it take to make a cup of coffee from one of those big coffee chains?
Yeah, that takes about 37 gallons or 140 liters of water. So that most of that water is for the growing of the coffee beans. You know, it's a tropical plant and it takes a lot of water to grow the beans, but also a fair amount of processing and, of course, transport from tropical areas also uses water in the form of the fuel that it takes to get it to your cup.
Well, you know, I just got a funny image of, if we wanted to be real about this, we should take in a cup that will hold 140 liters or 37 gallons, and then we'd realize what we're buying at the store. And what about the clothes we wear? Are we soaking up the water with that too?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably wearing about 20,000 liters of water right now. And that's basically, you know, a pair of pants, a shirt, a sweatshirt, and some socks, and a pair of shoes. That's how much water it takes to make all of those materials.
It is amazing. So how were you able to calculate these amounts of water used for different consumer products?
Well, I used a research based out of a university in the Netherlands called the University of Twente. And they are the pioneers of the whole water footprint concept. And so they've developed analytical tools to determine how much water it takes to make things. And so I used all their research as a baseline for all of the numbers in the book.
Are there other crazy water-intensive products that maybe we should avoid?
You know, that's actually a hard question to answer because it all depends on how they're made and where they're made. So it's more complicated than I would have liked the issue to be. But I think one thing that is key for listeners to understand is disposable products, basically disposable anything, ends up having a much greater water footprint. So one example I give in the book is disposable diapers versus cloth diapers. So a cloth diaper, 4 gallons, disposable diaper, 144 gallons. Why such a big difference? Well, you're reusing the cloth diaper over and over again, and the amount of water it takes to wash the diaper isn't that much in comparison to the amount of water it takes to make a disposable diaper, which has, you know, basically wood pulp and a bunch of other fibers that requires a lot of water to produce.
Well, that makes sense. You know, Steve, I remember Lester Brown of World Watch saying countries don't export wheat, they export the water used to grow it. And places like Australia can hardly afford to do that. Talk to us about the water trade involved in globalized agriculture.
Yeah, that's an enormous volume of water basically flowing from Australia to other countries. Australia is the biggest exporter of what's called virtual water, so water and food products, in the world, and it's the driest continent in the world. And, you know, this is kind of one of those things when you go, that doesn't really make sense, and it doesn't. But this is also the case in other countries. Other countries like Egypt ship thousands and thousands of pounds of oranges to Europe. And, of course, Egypt is a very dry country. Oranges require a lot of water. You know, should they be doing that, growing that crop instead of providing food for their own people? One way to envision this, it's not just food products, it's also other types of products. So China is shipping enormous volumes of water in the form of electronics and, I don't know, furniture and other products to the U.S. and Canada. So if you imagine this huge, huge river of water flowing out of China into Canada and the U.S., it's an incredible number, and it's in the book. But this is something that we, I think, need to get a grip on, these huge virtual water flows between countries.
Yeah, in China, parts of northern China are drying up. The Gobi Desert is expanding. Desertification is a big problem there. Plus, they have very little fresh water left. So much of it is polluted. So it's a big issue. Now, is fast food a part of the problem?
It can be. It doesn't have to be. It all depends on where the food is grown and what food is being sold. So some foods, such as burgers, so beef, is very water intensive. It's, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 gallons of water per kilogram, so 2 pounds of beef. So it's one of those really heavy water use. But it all depends on where it's grown and what they're offering. So it's not quite as clear as saying fast food is bad.
All right. Now, I have to question this a little bit. It seems like there is a lot of water in the world. Isn't there enough? Stephen Leahy, how do you know there really is a water problem?
Yeah, it looks like, at least when you're in Canada. If you're in California, perhaps you don't see it the same way. So we've got the droughts in California, and we've got droughts throughout the Sahel and Africa. There's droughts in many, many places in the world. Statistically, people are looking at all the numbers of water and consumption of water, and continually we're running into this sort of water shortage. So about 1.2 billion people face chronic water shortages right now. There's another 2.5 billion who occasionally face water shortages. So we're getting more and more people are being affected by water shortages. And there really isn't that much fresh water in the world. It's only a tiny percentage of all the water on the entire planet.
So it's hard to picture the lives of people who face water shortages. We see images of women walking a few miles with containers that they're carrying with water. It's hard to imagine those lives where just getting water is a big part of your day.
Yeah, I mean, only about half of the world has access to piped water, so water being piped into where they're living. So the other half of the world have to haul it from wells or streams. And about 20% of all the people in the world, they don't actually have access to clean water. So they're having to drink and cook with, you know, very bad water that makes them sick on a regular basis.
Yeah. So on our current path, what are experts predicting for the year 2050?
Well, they're predicting pretty dire scenarios when it comes to water. Even by 2025, which isn't that far away now, 3 in 5 people will be facing water shortages, the experts predict. You know, because we have to remember that we use water for energy production. All forms of energy need water. We use water, of course, for food and for all of our products. So as the numbers of people in terms of population grow, as well as consumption grows, we're using more and more water. And, you know, we're already having hit the limit in many places. You know, California being a good example of a place that's already having its water bubble burst.
Yeah, it reminds me that fracking is kind of a water crime. They take mountains and mountains of water, poison it essentially, and then inject it into the deep earth, we hope, to get rid of it. So it's a way of getting rid of fresh water. This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is environmental journalist Stephen Leahy. We're talking about his surprising new book, Your Water Footprint. Stay tuned for more on your impact on water shortages in faraway countries and nature deficit disorder.
Greetings, my friends. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friends, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence, based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking fact about
the world of tomorrow, the world of tomorrow, the world of tomorrow?
Welcome back. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with more on the hidden international transfer of valuable water. Then we'll ask, How would I know if I had nature deficit disorder? And what can we do about it?
Radio EcoShock.
There's been a lot of news about millions of people, Steve, in Sao Paulo, Brazil, almost running out of water. Their aquifer is threatened for some reason. Do you know anything about the situation there?
Well, I know a little bit about it. There's been a long-term problem of decreasing rainfall in southern Brazil, and this has been linked to the deforestation of the Amazon rainforest. So the Amazon produces its own weather, if you like, and it's been responsible for providing rain to the southern parts of Brazil for thousands of years. But so much of it has been cut away that it can no longer perform this function, and it's one of the reasons why Sao Paulo is suffering right now.
And in the United States, more millions of people depend on that big underground reserves in the Ogallala Aquifer. People joke about that, saying certain states would dry up and blow away without it. How big is the Ogallala, and is it possible that could run out someday?
It is really big. It's one of the world's biggest water bodies, although it's underground. It's about contains the volume of Lake Huron, so that's something like 866 cubic miles. It's an enormous resource. I think it's the second or third largest underground aquifer, but it's being depleted 14 times faster than it can recharge. Now it's 14 times faster, and it's dropping about 9 feet every year. By 2030, 2035, there isn't going to be much water left in it, a recent study showed.
Well, I suppose after reading your book, it would be handy if every product label stated the amount of water consumed in making it along with the energy used in it. Do you see that day coming?
Not really. It's difficult to do labeling on products, specific numbers. They could say this might be a water smart product, and I think that would be helpful in the sense that it's grown in a place where the water is being used sustainably. Now that, something like a green labeling would be, I think, very helpful, because otherwise it's very confusing or very complicated for people to be able to figure this out.
I agree. Now, Stephen Lay, I know you've covered international environment meetings for years. Are scientists or leaders starting to be concerned with this hidden global water trade in consumer products?
They are. They are in the sense that they call it the nexus. This is the new buzzword in that field. The combination of increasing consumption, increasing population, increasing need for more energy, all of this means increased water use. And now we're in an era of climate change, which makes rainfall much less predictable. We get too much water where we don't need it and not enough where we do. This is seen to be probably the biggest issue we're going to have to come to grips along with climate change this century.
Yeah, I know. As you say, scientists say the world's deserts will expand even as wet places get heavier deluges. What can local communities do to improve their water resilience?
I think one of the things they need to understand is, what is the sustainable capacity of our water system that we have, our water basin, our underground resources? Really need to have that sort of baseline. What's the recharge rates? How much water can we actually use on a sustainable basis? And a lot of places don't have any idea about that. Places like even in California, there's no rules about pumping groundwater out of the ground. Anybody can sink a well and suck up as much water as they like. So we need to understand also to value our water resources and then protect them. Now, protect them means protecting the riparian areas, so the wetlands and the forest areas that keep our water clean and actually help us prevent floods. They can hold water during dry periods so that we'll still continue to have fresh water when we need it.
Yeah, my broadcast studio is in a desert-like area. We actually have some wild cactus growing outside, and yet people have lawns and they keep pumping and pumping and pumping water. It's almost like a contest to see who can have the greenest lawns, and I'm hoping that will change. I know Las Vegas, for example, has started buying back lawns that give you money for what you convert to a real sustainable landscape that fits where it is. One of the things I wonder is, how can we help as global citizens? Can you give us a few tips from your new book?
Yeah, the book has quite a few suggestions. Certainly, the starting point is to value and appreciate the fact that we need water for everything, and then to think about things like diet. A meat diet uses a lot more water than a vegetarian diet, so that's just the simple fact of what it takes to grow and produce. So you could reduce your daily water use by about 1,300 liters or roughly 400 gallons a day just by switching to a vegetarian diet. Another good suggestion, I think, is to meatless Mondays, which has become quite trendy. That's a big, for a family of four, that would save enormous amounts of water, 200, 300,000 gallons a year. Another thought is, you know, the 3 R's, the good old 3 R's, reduce, reuse, recycle. And this is especially true, of course, for products. Clothing, you know, go to the thrift stores. Take your clothes to the thrift store. We all have closets full of clothes that are just sitting there. Those are all sort of practical, useful thing. I mean, it's really, water use is connected to consumption. Consumption of energy, consumption of products, and consumption of food. One of the things about food is that we waste about 30 to 40% of our food in North America. And obviously, that means all the water that it took to grow that, we're also wasting.
Steve, one of the things I love about your new book, it isn't pages of type. I just wasn't ready for another long read. This one's loaded with maps and graphs, and it takes us right to that key information visually, quickly. It's one of the books that's going right beside my desk where I can grab it for a reference. Listeners, you can look in the usual places for this book, Your Water Footprint, the shocking facts about how much water we use to make everyday products. You can follow the writings of Stephen Leahy at his website, stephenleahy.net. Stephen has a PH in it, and Leahy is spelled L-E-A-H-Y. Steve, can you tell us about a couple of stories you're working on now?
Yeah, I'm working on toxic pollution sites in the developing world. So around the developing world, there are hundreds of thousands of toxic polluted sites. I mean, a lot of countries who are in their rapid growth to industrialization are using a lot of old technology that we used to use that are highly polluting. Cleaning them up is difficult. There's a huge impact on people's health, and that's going to affect the ability of these countries to develop. So that's a huge problem. It's probably going to be, I think, a major issue in the next decade when people begin to realize the seriousness of it.
Yeah, you know, in the States, people still remember Love Canal. It was where all sorts of toxic chemicals were dumped, and there are Superfund sites around the United States, but I'm imagining that they're probably nothing compared to what's happening in the developing world as we make these quickie consumer products with very toxic production facilities, and we may have toxic hotspots that won't be inhabitable or people will be sick wherever they do live around them for a century or two to come. It's sad to think about that.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's exactly right. And so this is, I think, another one of the big pressing problems that we have to face. Of course, the other one I'm working on is the upcoming climate change conference in Lima, Peru, which is the UN meetings to form a new international climate change treaty.
Well, we kind of throw our hands up about those climate meetings. They don't seem to do anything. And yet there is public pressure building on these leaders. It's becoming more politically acceptable, in some countries at least, to talk about it. Do you see any hope for this? Are we going to get any international action in this decade?
Yeah. We will definitely get the action. We will get action. We won't get the action we need, unfortunately, without a lot of public pressure. It's really going to take people marching in the streets as they did in New York in September and other cities around the world. It's going to take more of that kind of public push to get us to take the, you know, necessary actions to avert, you know, a climate catastrophe. I mean, there are other countries that have actually figured this out, and like Germany is moving along really quickly. There's no disagreement at any political level by any party that they're going to be zero carbon as soon as possible. And they want to develop the technology and the jobs as fast as possible because they know this is the future, and they're going to be well ahead of many other countries, namely Canada and the U.S., because they'll have all the technologies and the expertise, and we're going to have to buy it from them.
Well, there you have it, StephenLeahy.net. I can't tell you the number of times that I've read a story of Steve's, and then about 6 months later, it becomes big news in the mainstream media, so that's a good place to tune in if you are concerned about the environment. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.